Alright, welcome to class today! He's glad to see you all here. In case you didn't know, this is where I think you are, CS3330 Computer Architecture. If you were thought you were somewhere else, there are multiple exits. You're welcome to find one. I am Professor Tykonovich. It is said like this. Tykonovich! I find students are more happy to talk to me if they know how to say my name. So, I'm going to count to three, and you're all going to say my name in unison. Tykonovich is how it said. 1, 2, 3. Tykonovich. Whee! All right. One day you'll have the joy of having 150 people chant your name. Won't that be exciting? All right. This is computer architecture. CS3330. I have taught this class before, but it has been some years. So I may be occasionally slightly rusty, but I hope it'll work out just fine. Many of you are on the waiting list. That is, some of you may get off the waiting list if the waiting list goes down. I have been instructed by the powers that be for the time being not to change the course enrollment cap. So I'm expecting the waiting list will remain the waiting list for a while until people drop. We will talk a little bit about that as we move forward. My goal today is first just to sort of remind you how this course works. I assume you have taken courses before at UVA during the post-COVID times and understand how things work, but we'll try to hit the highlights. And then we will dive right into some material. What should you know? There's me and TAs, and you can contact us. Huzzah! There's ways of contacting us via Piazza or office hours or NanoFeedback. We also have a Discord channel. How should you decide where to send things? If you think it has a short answer, Discord's great. If you think it needs a longer answer, Piazza or office hours would be appropriate. We have not yet scheduled the office hours. You will get to give us some feedback as to when you would like us to do that coming up. I'm also a big fan of anonymous feedback. Last time I taught this class, I checked, I got over 300 pieces of anonymous feedback during the course of the semester. It was great. I encourage you to use anonymous feedback. I won't be able to respond to it generally, so we'll sometimes take lecture time to respond to the anonymous feedback. You will need a textbook. I realize you've been in CS for a while, so this may be a shock. There is a textbook and you will use it. There will be quizzes to measure how much you've learned from the textbook before class sometimes. And there are assignments that will be almost impossible if you don't have the textbook. Because of this, I have worked with the library. The bookstore is trying out a new thing for textbooks where they will post a digital copy of the textbook on Colab. So you can go to Colab today and get access to the textbook. I mention this in part because, huzzah, there's access to the textbook. And because if you decide you don't want to pay the bookstore for access to this, you have to opt out. So at 2-week mark, they will charge all of your student accounts for the textbook unless you do some stuff. And there's a description of what you need to do here. You can click this description to pop to see how all that works. And so if you want to get the textbook in some other way or want to fail the class by not having the textbook, then you're welcome to opt out, and they have the instructions how to do that there. You have 2 weeks to do it in. So there is that that you should know. If you're wondering how you get to the textbook, you just go to Colab. Come on, Colab. Ah! And you go to our course, and you click the UVA Bookstore Inclusive Access, and it waits for a while, and then you click the textbook. I can never remember where you click. There's somewhere on here you click. Maybe I need to scroll down and click the read now, and then you will have the textbook. I've seen online textbooks that looked prettier than this, but it works pretty well. There is weird times frequently in the figures on the printed textbook generally show up at the tops of pages. Let me scroll up here. I've been looking at it a bit before. And so often you will be reading through and you will realize that there's this figure that's like right in the middle of the text, such as, they are finite, aside origins of the C programming language. Approximations that can be. Sorry. But there it is. So anyway, We will be using the textbook quite a bit in this class. We will also have class meetings. Surprise! I have a slightly different attitude about class meetings than some faculty. If you don't want to be here, I don't want you here. I am not going to do anything graded in class. And wouldn't it be fun if I had a class of 20 students that I could get to know all of them and the rest of you stayed home? I hope you also want to be in that class of 20 students, but then of course you'll all stay, so anyway. But if you don't want to be here, don't come. If you do come, I hope you will pay attention and not distract other students. So if you are thinking, oh, the right thing to do during this class is do my homework for another class, that may be the right thing to do, but please don't do it in front of somebody else who will be distracted by your screen, etc. So there's that. Lab is a little different. Labs will generally, labs will be handled different ways, different labs, but many labs, you will need to be present in lab, and the TAs will check off that you have shown them something. Labs are primarily designed to teach you and prepare you for the subsequent homework. So in general, lab homework pairs will go together. There will be a lab on Wednesday, and then after that, a homework will come live that will be due before the next lab. They'll be related to what you did in lab. So in general, we're going to grade labs based on, did you get started? Did you play nicely with others and help this work? And then homeworks will be graded based on, did you succeed? We should also note about time. When I have taught this class in the past, admittedly it's been some years, but the last time I taught it, many students said it was their most time-consuming class. And I said, great, how much time did you spend? And the answer was, well, you were supposed to spend in all classes according to provost policy. So I saw no reason to reduce the number of hours. So, I do expect you to be spending upwards of 10 hours a week on this class. And there's going to be a lot of variation because not everybody codes at the same time. And I suggest that you set aside time for this in advance so that you will not be surprised when it comes along. I'm getting annoyed by that shadow. Okay. Yeah. And we have a grading policy and so forth, as many other classes do. I don't expect much of that will be a surprise, so I don't plan to spend time on it unless there's questions about it. Huzzah, a class. Questions? Yes?
Is there a lab today?
Is there lab today? An excellent question. Let's see if I can figure out the answer. Let's see. Is it help? Nope, that's how I get help. That's grading policy. I doubt it's a quiz. Let's see the schedule. Oh, look, lab setup. Let's look at this. This lab grade is ungraded and unstaffed. In theory, you've already done all of this in a previous course. Many subsequent assignments to send on this class. So this lab is something you should do, but you should just do it on your own. And our hope is most of it will be easy because you've done it before. It's getting set up so you can do other things. In particular, you'll need access to Linux, access to an x86-64 processor, a C compiler, the utility make, and Python 3. And we have various techniques for getting that to happen. Other questions? Yes?
Is it different than 2150 if you have one of the new MacBooks with the M1 processor that's not x86?
There are assignments that will require x86 processors. You don't necessarily have to have your own. We are officially supported. Let's go back to the lab write-up. The officially supported solution is do your assignments on the department Linux machines. So hopefully most of you received an email about a department login account. If you don't already have one, you either already know how to log into the department servers or you got an email recently. Is there anybody that this does not describe? They neither already have a CS department Linux account nor got an email. I did not get either one of those. Good. So that is our official solution to all things. Many of the assignments you'll be able to do anywhere. But some of them will require you to use a server, and that is the server we officially support. There are many alternatives you can use if you want to use alternatives, and we describe how to do those in this lab as well. You're welcome to play around with. Other questions? Okay. I should also mention something. I mentioned if you don't want to be in class, don't come. What does that mean you learn the material? I'm recording lecture. You can tell I'm recording lecture because in the bottom left corner of the screen, there's a little red dot. I will probably forget to start the recording at least one class. If you see me talking and don't see the little red dot, please remind me so that people get the recording. After class, I'll go back to my office, combine the audio and the video, and post it on the schedule. So hopefully within 15, 30 minutes of class, it'll be up. Should definitely be within an hour. I'll also run it through an AI voice recognizer to make something vaguely like subtitles, but they won't work beautifully. If you need subtitles for hard of hearing or the like, then I can get the resources to make good ones. But for now, we'll just do okay ones. All right. You will notice there is a quiz due every Monday. Oh, yes, question. I would expect that to be more confusing than helpful. The two sections of CS3330 have the same learning outcomes, but very different approaches to get there. So everything that is said in either class is true for the other class too, but the order and approach will be significantly different, and I would expect trying to synchronize them would be challenging. Other questions? All right, let's say a bit word about quizzes. You will notice there is a quiz before class every week. Let's click one of those. And then let's also change me into somebody that I'm not so that you can see what you'll see. So, the quizzing site. Here are all of the quizzes. There will be 11 of them. You will notice that they are all close at 3 o'clock on a Monday. 3 o'clock, so that I have a chance to look and see how you did and decide if I need to address anything in class at 3:30. These will, in general, have a mix of questions reviewing the previous week's content and questions reviewing your understanding of the current week's readings. They will come live. You will notice they open on, well, this one is a little bit different, but they will, in general, open after class on Wednesday. I think that's actually... I'm not sure I have all my open dates right. The plan is to have them open on Thursday so I have a chance to integrate what we talked about and then post them, and then you'll have Thursday through the following Monday to take them. I traditionally have had pretty low grades on my quizzes. Last time I took this, did this class, the raw average on the quizzes, I believe, was about 65%. We'll say some more about that in a moment. One of the quizzes is already here. In case you haven't seen this quizzing site before, this quizzing site doesn't let you submit anything. Oh no, there is no submit button. That's because everything you do is recorded the moment you do it. So, you can enter comments on each question. When should you? What do we think are the answers to question one? Let's see. There is a comment box. The comment box's purpose is to make quizzes that might be confusing. So you can tell us what you found confusing. So ambiguous or confusing, absolutely. Note where in lecture reading we gave the answer, not really useful, but you do need to document any external sources because otherwise it'd be plagiarism. And so that would be my answer. You'll notice every time I change something, there's a brief flash, maybe even too short to notice, of a sort of a yellowish or orangish color background, and then it switches to green. The green means it is talked to the server and the server said, I got your answer. If it doesn't turn green, reload the quiz page to reestablish your connection to the server. If you can't reload the quiz page, if it doesn't work or so on, email me and we'll try to figure out what's going on. But it should just instantly take everything you say. You'll notice if I go in the comment box and start typing something, I am typing something. It is showing me the I haven't submitted this yet color. How do I submit? I literally just go anywhere outside the box. Ta-da! And now it's submitted. Okay, and whatever the state of the quiz is when the time limit expires, you'll notice I have 119 hours to finish this quiz. Whatever the time, whatever the content is what will be graded. There will then be a second process sometime later, usually about a week later, where we will read your comments and see if we think we should adjust your scores. So get an initial right away, here's the key, here's what we think the answer is. And then a little while later, you will get any adjustments. A few days later, a week later, you'll get adjustments we might make. The first quiz, quiz zero, is due on Monday and will be graded, but won't be part of your grade. It's to help you understand how the quizzing site works and get you ready for the course. You will also notice if you go to the quizzing site, you probably don't see this as question one, because it shuffles the orders of questions and answers for each student. Anyway, there's that. Okay. So you'll have quizzes. We also will have exams. My attitude towards making exams in this class is, so most people make exams where they ask several questions they expect everybody to get right. That feels like a waste of time. Of everybody's time. My time writing the question, your time taking the question. So I just skip those questions and I only ask questions I expect many of you will get wrong. This makes my exams feel really hard. It makes the raw average fairly low. I generally adjust for that low average in advance by figuring out what I think the average will be and adjusting for it. I do it before, not after you take the exam, which is, means it's technically not a curve. But anyway, that tends to happen. That said, I've still ended a fairly low average compared to other courses when I've taught this course in the past. Last time I taught it, I gave out the lowest GPA of any course in our department. I'm not shooting for that, but we're covering a lot of material that experience has told me not all of you will find interesting, and that tends to show up. But yeah, that's you'll have two midterms. They will be given during the lab time, so you'll have an hour and 15 minutes on them instead of 50 minutes to give you a little more time, and then there will also be a final exam. They will look similar to the quizzes, but will be on paper instead. I may try to get you some copies of previous exams if I can, although I don't have those ready yet. And then you'll also, most weeks, have coding that you'll submit. Not always will it be coding, but often it'll be something you coded that you'll submit most weeks as well. And that is what you'll be doing. All right, I think that's all the logistics I have. And we do have help. Hopefully you've seen things like this before. We have a queue where you can go and ask for help. We have Discord for quick questions and for online synchronous office hours. And we have in-person office hours as well. It's possible we'll move the office hours. We haven't scheduled them yet. One of the quiz zero questions is fill out this poll telling us when you want office hours to be. So we'll wait until we see the results of that before we schedule office hours. All right, my plan is from here to move into content of what you should be learning in this course. So take a moment, turn to somebody you're not sitting next to, see if you have any questions. Maybe also meet them and say hi, because that makes life more pleasant. I'll see if there are any questions, and then we'll move on. What are your questions? Yes.
You said the quizzes were about the previous week's content and that week's readings.
Other questions? I'll answer the questions after I collect them. Yes? Yes. Sorry, I missed a few words. Say it again. Okay. Okay, let's start with the easy question first. Can you lab hop? No. Why not? You might be wondering to yourself. There's a couple of reasons. One is that it makes it difficult to staff the labs if we don't know how many people will be there. But also, we know that you will have a better experience if you make friends in the course with whom you can talk about course content. And we know that only some of you will do that without the help of having lab mates. So you should attend your lab, and you should get to know the same people and sit with them and chat with them and maybe hang out with them on other times and study with them and so on. But the short answer is no. If there is a special case where there is one particular lab where you can't make your usual time but could make the other time, you should bring that up with your lab TAs the week before, and they can communicate with the other lab TAs that you have a reason to swap. But in general, no, you should go to your lab. The content of the quizzes, yes, that's correct. It is about the previous week's lecture content and the coming week's reading content. Sometimes to ask a question about that, I have to ask about earlier stuff as well, because things integrate. But my goal is to measure what did you learn last week and how ready are you for this week? Me. So, I mentioned that I'll have a fairly low raw average on exams and so on because I'm not going to ask the questions I expect everybody to get right. And so I adjust to that by a nonlinear weighting function. How do I do this? I write the exam, and then I go through the exam three times. The first time I think, what will somebody that should be barely passing get right? And then I go through again and say, what will somebody that's doing quite well get right? And then I'll go through a third time saying, what do I expect a student that's not doing okay should get right? And I'll pick those three numbers and I will fit a curve to them, basically, to try to adjust for the fact that I might be asking questions with a lower raw average than you have. I generally won't tell you what that curve is. I find that telling you what the curve is makes some of you freak out or spend a lot of time trying to do weird math to see what you think your score is. So generally speaking, I'll decide it in advance but not reveal it until afterwards. And you'll do your best you can, and then it'll work out fine. So this question is an interesting question because my initial response was one thing, and then I realized why this was an interesting question. My initial response was, yes, of course, because it's happened before lab. But then I realized there's, 15 minutes between this class and the first lab? And if you chose to stay home, that's awkward. So I may need to revisit this. So I guess currently the answer is yes, but I'll try to make it know in the future. We'll see how well we can do that. The correlation between lecture and lab will not always be super tight. There'll be related content, but in general, I design labs to try to get you ready for assignments. They are based on lecture material and reading material to some degree, but they're not. It's not like I'll lecture you how to do something and then you'll do it in lab. There'll be a somewhat more of a disconnect there sometimes. So I'll try to make it so that you don't have to have that in time in case you want to watch the recordings instead. Any other questions? Or follow-ons to these before we dive into course material? Okay. Let's see what our course material for the day was. It says we should do chapter 1 and chapter 2.3 of Computer Systems, A Programmer's Perspective, our textbook. Although I realize many of you may not have realized you should read those in advance. So let's go through what that looks like. I should first open up some things here. Let's grab those. Okay. I'm going to start with some pictures from the textbook. Starting with chapter 1. Chapter 1's goal in the textbook is to get you familiar with what the textbook will cover. And I think that's a useful goal for getting you used to what the course will cover. Get you ready for what's going on. So here we have a picture. In theory, you've seen versions of this picture before in CS2150, but probably not this exact picture. And you may not have thought about all of the pieces in between. One of the things we're going to try to do to get you ready, we'll do it in the first few weeks here, is make you understand a little bit about where do programs come from and how do they run. We're going to teach you how computers work, but the work computers do is run programs, so we're going to have to understand programs. And so we're going to talk to some degree, although we assume you've seen some of these ideas before, about how we take a source program. The common source language we'll use most often in this class is C. There's some talk in the textbook about why C is a good pick. C was designed concurrently with the Unix operating system, effectively to be a better way of writing assembly. It has almost no interesting abstractions. It has functions, loops, and ifs. And that's about it. It lets you do stupid things. You've written C++, which is like trying to fix C and make it usable. And so this is not going to do that. So we'll see some C, which we'll be able to talk about how every part of C gets turned into assembly fairly easily. There's technically a thing here that in theory you learned about. I don't know how well you remember it. This preprocessor. I want to just know how you feel about the preprocessor to know if we need to spend time on it. So we're just going to do a quick finger poll somewhere near your chest, unless you want everybody to see it. I want you to hold up a number of fingers. 5 is, I can explain how the preprocessor works. 0 is, I've never heard this word before. How do you feel about the preprocessor? All right, 1s and 2s with a handful of zeros. So, let's just say a few things about the preprocessor. You have written things like include foo. So, what does this mean? Literally, what happens is there is a program that is run over your source code before we compile it. It is called the C preprocessor, or CPP. It looks for any line that starts with a hashtag and does what it says. So when it says include foo.h, it says, oh, that means go read the file foo.h and put all of its characters right here. It's a copy-paste command. And that is literally, it just runs through and does this. It also accepts things like define. So I can say define x to be 1 plus 2. And it says, oh, good. I'll run through your file, and anywhere you have a capital X, I will replace it with the character 1 space plus space 2. It has no idea what C is doing. It is a stupid system that runs forward first and just does these basic operations. We will occasionally use these. We may talk a little bit more about function style defines and so forth as they become appropriate. But they are an important part of how C and C++ work. They have nothing to do with architecture. but they're prevalent enough in low-level code that you'll need to understand them, so we may talk a little bit more about them as we go forward. When we're done pre-processing a C file, we end up with a C file. If we need to save it as something, the traditional form is to save it .i for the intermediate form. But it's the same language, it's still C. It just has removed all of these hashtag things. And then that gets compiled down into assembly. Assembly is a rough textual wrapper around the machine language, as hopefully you learned in 2150. And so really, we don't need to make the assembly, we need to make the program. But we make this thing, and then we turn that into a program. There's actually several steps there. You probably didn't talk about the relocatable objects at all. But the idea here is that when I have some file that has code in it, I often want to take several such files and combine them into one program. And so there's this notion of a relocatable object, or a binary, the .o files. They've turned everything into assembly, but include some extra information about how we can move them around and combine them to make a larger program. And then there's a linker that takes all of our O programs and makes them something that can actually be executed. When we say actually be executed, it contains the assembly, but also some information for the operating system to know how to load it into memory. Right? And so they're going to have different formats on different operating systems. So this pipeline all happens. We're mostly going to talk about how we run assembly, how we build hardware to run assembly. Okay? But we're going to try to connect that back to how you write software. And to do that, we're going to have to remember there are several steps along the way. And things the preprocessor can handle for us don't run on the processor at all, and they're going to need to understand some of that difference. So we're going to come back and talk some more about pieces of this at various times in the course. Questions? Okay. We will see some version of this magical picture many times this course. This is the textbook author's picture of what a computer is. Let's briefly talk through the pieces of this. Let's start with the things that you probably have heard at least a little bit about before. We have a thing called a CPU, the Central Processing Unit. The CPU does the work, and we're mostly going to talk about the CPU in this class. It does the actual processing of things. It is more complicated than you might expect. But there's pieces of it that you've learned as you learned a little assembly. You learned about registers. These ideas of these named, although in practice they're actually numbered under the hood, these named locations where we can put information. There's a small number of them, 16 in the processing systems we're going to deal with. There is a program counter, something that tells me where in the code I am, what line of code should I run next. We have this thing called the Arithmetic Logic Unit, or the ALU, which does the work, but it's going to be a fairly small part of what the CPU does, because most of what it's going to deal with is keeping track of where it is and what values are being stored. And that's going to be sort of on the CPU in the most simple form. We'll add some more here in a moment. We're also going to have it talking to lots of other things. Memory is the big one. Addresses are part of assembly. Addresses are typically not handled by the CPU alone. There is some ability to talk to main memory, this separate thing, so you can swap in and out RAM chips and so forth. So we'll talk some about how this relationship between the CPU and memory works. There are also lots of other things. If all the CPU could do is talk to memory, you would never know what it did. So we need that system to be able to talk to the mouse and the keyboard and the screen and the disk and so forth. And we're going to mostly hand wave over that part. We'll occasionally dive into little pieces of it, but for the most part, we're going to focus our attention up here. And just occasionally talk about what happens when we talk to peripherals. Part of the reason we're going to do that is because these outlying things tend to be self-sustaining, and many of them, and they change frequently. So in the time that I have been working in computers, for example, the fact that this is a USB controller, that has changed. It was a PS2 controller, and then it was a serial port controller. And anyway, the design of these change fairly often. We will, however, talk about what this thing called a bus is. and why we care about buses and how they work to some small degree. So this is largely where we're going to focus, is on the hardware. How does it work? With the idea that it works for the software. And so the things we do to make a better CPU need to make it better to run code. And in general, that means code we can think of at the C level or occasionally at the assembly level. There is a piece that we'll actually talk about more fairly early on. In a couple weeks, we're going to start talking about caches. Part of memory, a very small part of memory, will actually be on the CPU chip. And more of memory will be outside. And we're going to move parts back and forth. And so this is going to be something we're going to talk about because it's going to have a significant impact in how we run programs, and actually some impact on security and other things as well as we move forward. Here we have a beautiful triangle. Everybody loves a triangle. It turns out we have so many levels of storage. So when you write assembly, you have your registers, but you have typically 16 of them in x86-64. If you have an M1 processor, you have 31. If you have an x86 before 64, you have 8. They're somewhere in this general range of registers. That's not much. And you've probably thought about, to some degree, main memory, RAM. This is where you have things you can address, right? When I'm going and out and talking about an address of something, a pointer and so on, we're thinking in general about an index into main memory. It turns out, though, that main memory is hundreds to thousands of times slower than registers. And so we really, really don't want to go to main memory very often. And so what we do is we make a bunch of smaller memories in between. The smaller they are, the closer together the pieces can be, the fewer transistors we will need to access them, and the faster they can be. And so what we're typically going to do is we're going to take the fact that there's gigabytes of main memory, and we're going to take a little chunk of this main memory out and store it in the L3 cache, which will be an order of magnitude faster, but also an order of magnitude smaller. And then we're going to take a little chunk of that out and put it in the L2 cache, which will again be sort of an order of magnitude smaller and faster. And so on down through the system, so that our hope is that most of the time you'll do everything in the L1 cache, but sometimes you'll get the L2 or the L3 or the L4, and maybe all the way back and have to go out to disk. Okay? And this idea of this sort of hierarchy of systems, the purpose here is to make things fast, but without removing the possibility of doing fancier things. Now, when you wrote assembly in 2150, you didn't even have to know this exists. And that's because when we're writing code, the hardware is going to try to hide this from you. So the interface you have with the hardware just pretends like you only have memory. It says DRAM, main memory, is all that exists. Under the hood, it is handling all of the caches. It is moving things back and forth and trying to make accesses fast. But it's not going to show you, the programmer, that. So you can write simple programs and fancy things can happen under the hood. So as we're talking about architecture of computers, we're going to deal a lot more with more than how do you add numbers? How do you jump to the next line of code? Because we're also going to have to deal with how do I take the things you asked to do and make them fast enough that you won't be upset? And there's going to be lots of examples of how complicated this gets beyond just caching as we're exploring hardware architecture. The other thing we're going to talk about is sort of briefly get towards the idea of operating systems. We have a whole course in operating systems. And we'll dive into many topics in more detail. But a big thing we want to do as we're dealing with running our software is we want to be able to protect users from themselves. Imagine if I could write program poorly and it would happen to do whatever the thing is that goes out to disk and changes files on disk, or goes to the screen and changes pixels. What if having the bad pointer meant I went to somewhere out in memory and changed the screen? That would be bad. I don't want to be able to do that. I don't want to be able to corrupt files that I wasn't trying to access. And so a lot of things we're going to do are going to be protected from them. The user code that you usually write is going to run in this fake world where it pretends like it has access to everything. There is no ability to access things that don't exist, that shouldn't exist. And if I really want to actually be able to talk to a disk, I have to go talk to a special privileged piece of code called the kernel or the operating system. Creating that separation so your code doesn't have to worry about a bad pointer doing something strange is going to have to be handled by the hardware. You're going to have to create all of the tools and the hooks to allow this two-world environment to live, where there's some operations that can only be done by the operating system, only by the kernel code, and some operations that can be done by any user, and I can have two programs running at the same time with no chance of them stomping on each other. And so a separation of multiple processes, kernels versus users. We're not going to build those pieces in this class, but we're going to talk about how we make the hardware that enables them to be built. So we're going to have to understand how all of these things work, how the disk can talk to us even though it takes millions of cycles to do anything and we don't have to wait for it, and so on. So it'll be another thing we're going to understand as we move forward. Did you see a picture like this in 2150? Yes, I've seen a picture like this before. No, I don't think so. I am still alive. Oh my. We have fewer people alive than have seen this picture. That's concerning. All right. This picture is not required to exist. There's nothing in the hardware that says there has to be a picture like this. But when we're dealing with memory, there's traditions of having different kinds of memory. And one of the things we do want the hardware to know is we want it to be able to tell the difference between different kinds of memory. When I load in the printf function, for example, lots and lots of programs are going to use printf or other display tools. It would be nice if I only had to load one copy into memory. So I'd like to be able to have 10 programs running, but only load in printf once. And so we want to be able to have this idea of some memory that is shared. But as soon as I share it, well, now I have danger. If you happen to write a byte into that memory in your program, it can mess up all of the others. So I want to also make this read-only, so that I can load a copy in, everybody can run the code, but nobody can change it. That makes it safe to have it shared. But I could also have other read-only things. I could say, you know, the code that you gave me, I probably don't want your code to modify itself. There are cases where I might, but in general, I assume your code should be read-only. But there's some stuff that you should be able to read and write. There's also some place in memory I want to store information that you aren't allowed to touch, read or write. Information that tells me what other processes are running, for example. I want to be able to know what other processes are running so that I can run them all, but I don't want your code to be able to see that. And so I might want to have some part of memory that your user code can't see at all. And so as we're designing memory, in addition to being able to make it look like two different programs have their completely own address space so they can each use the same parts of memory, I also want to have different kinds of memory. And so what we're going to have is a thing we call virtual memory. The addresses that you type in your code are not only going to be addresses that get handled by the caches from RAM and through all the caches invisibly by the hardware, but are also not going to be the actual locations in memory. So I can have two programs running that both decide to have their code at the same bytes of memory. They're both loaded into memory at the same time, and I'm going to remap the bytes. So the address you told me goes to a different address on the RAM. That will also mean if you add more memory to your code, to your hardware, you don't need to change your code. I want my code to be able to ignore how much RAM is actually present and imagine it lived in this magical world where every imaginable address is okay. And so we're going to have this whole system of converting between the addresses we write in code and the addresses that actually exist. And along the way, we're also going to add in these read-only and can you execute it and is it shared between other people and is the kernel the only one that can read these extra flags to control what can be done. And this, in general, will be called virtual memory. It'll make our process of writing code much easier. It won't generally change the speed in any significant way, but it will make the safety of our code significantly easier if the hardware is capable of doing this for us. So what does this look like? We probably won't spend much time talking about this, but let's talk about this picture anyway. Your computer has more than one chip. Probably. And if it has only one chip, the chip probably has more than one core. And if it has only one core, the core can probably do multiple threads at once. A lot of the hardware is designed to be able to do multiple things at the same time. At a fundamental level, if I have two transistors, they're both running at once. Everything runs at the same time in the computer. And so part of what we're trying to do is make a design to allow us to make use of that running at the same time, so that I can make things run overall faster by making them run in parallel. And so we're going to have our caching system is going to be split out in some degree. Our cores, our registers, the processes are all going to be split out, and we're going to have to handle that to some degree in our processing as well. We'll talk some about these ideas in this class, get you as familiar with how they work. This is really a topic that we go into more in CS 4330, an elective advanced computer architecture that talks more about how we actually get these caches to be consistent and different process registers to work together and so on. Okay. That was my summary of the figures in section one, the rough scope of what we're talking about. So let's look and see what that looks like on our schedule. Okay. You'll notice that we're starting off, we're going to talk on Monday about assembly. Yes, I know you've learned assembly before. Confusingly, the textbook we like in this class and 2150 use different syntaxes for assembly, and we need to remind you a little bit about how that works. So next week we're going to talk about assembly. And then we're going to have you have a lab and a homework assignment that makes you use an assembly level debugger. Woo! You're going to read assembly code, I know. Then we're going to talk briefly about how compilation actually works. And then we're going to talk about bitwise operators and make sure you really understand how gates work in that way. And then we'll dive into caches. We'll spend a couple of days, a week on caches and have you build a cache simulator. We'll talk about virtual memory, and then we'll give you a midterm. So we're sort of talking about assembly and how memory works. After that, we have a lot of stuff about how processors work. I will put some more details here and some readings before we get there, but we're going to talk about how we actually make a processor able to do things efficiently, how we pipeline them, how we do multiple issue and so on. And we will have four labs and four homework assignments where you will implement a simulated processor with pipelining and so on using a processor description language called HCL. So that will be happening for a third of the class. And then we will talk about how we use it. So the last part of the class, we're going to talk about how we take what we've learned to make code that runs more quickly. And we're going to see, for example, how sometimes to understand why code runs slowly will require us to understand virtual memory, caching, and processor pipelining. And we'll figure out how we can use that to make things run more quickly. And you'll have some labs and homework assignments where we'll give you some code, and you will make it run 10-100 times faster than the code we gave you. Along the way, making the code a lot harder to read, because that often happens. This is what we have coming up in the class. Questions about the scope of the class? Yes?
I noticed that is the midterm the same week as the homework due?
Yeah.
Will there be any differences in how long the homework will take us, or is that how it is?
I'm not planning on that. The homework is due several hours before the exam. The final is cumulative, yeah. Yeah?
Where do we find the reading schedule?
You go to the schedule and you show the readings. And they're there. Yeah?
How many hours do we have for the midterm?
The midterms will happen during lab time for the normal lab time period, so 75 minutes. The plan right now is for them to be in-person supervised, yes. Other questions? Okay. Now, section 2.3 talks about integers. Everybody's favorite topic. You have learned how to encode integers in 2150. So we'll start with just Let's just see how much you remember. Is this number even or odd? Turn to your neighbor, see if you can agree.
Thank you.
So I can see how we're doing. Hold up a number of fingers. It's how many of these you think you have an answer to, which should be between 0 and 5. Okay, I'll give you a little while longer. Let's start with the first one. Even or odd? How do you know? Yeah, you only have to look at the last digit. What are the even digits? 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, and ace, A-C-E. Okay, this does not end with any of those, so it must be odd. Because B is odd. Hey, you learned this when you were learning decimal. It still works in hexadecimal. In particular, what is B? 11. We're going to use hex a lot in this class. I will sometimes even do arithmetic directly in hex because, you know, hex is going to be more useful to us. Sometimes we'll use binary. So I'm also going to expect you to be able to turn hex to binary. How would I turn this hex to binary? Well, that's 0001, 0010, 1100, 1011. If you don't know the binary of each individual hex digit, you're going to have to figure it out many, many times this semester. So it might be worth reminding yourself what those 16 patterns are. There are 16 of them. Memorizing them will make your life easier. Any questions about the first question? Yeah? Great question. When does Indianness matter? Can anybody yeah? Actually, no, processors don't care. There is something that cares, but it's not the processor. Indianness only matters when we're writing multi-byte values to a byte storage like RAM or a network. So it's only when we're taking a number or any other multi-byte value and needing to store it as individual bytes. The processor works with numbers in all of their bits. There is no concept of Indianness on the processor. The only time the processor needs to have Indianness is when it needs to send the number to RAM, or read the number from RAM, or send the number to the network, or read the number from the network. And almost all processors today do their RAM little endian and their network big endian. There's stories there, but yeah. But when we're dealing in the processor, when we're doing arithmetic, endian just isn't a thing. Other questions? Okay. Is OXFFFFFFFF positive or negative? How do you know it's negative? It is negative, absolutely true. How do I know? The sign bit is 1. How do I know that? Is it always the first digit? Because this also has a 1. But it's positive. Yeah. It's the first binary digit, which depends on the size of the number. So incidentally, I could make this positive in several ways. I could put a U here. How would adding a U change this number? What does the U suffix on an integer literal mean in C or C++? Unsigned. Okay? Does that mean it's incapable of storing signed values? I could also write an L at the end. What does L mean? Long. How many bits in a long? Usually 64. Depends a little on your processor. It's the same number as bits as there is in a pointer, but that's almost always 64 today. And so if I have 64 bits, I've only told you 32 of them are the bit 1. And so the remaining 32 are zeros, and it would be positive. This is a weirdness of C and C++ that will also show up in assembly. We're going to see this weirdness a lot. Okay? But this is a negative number as written. In decimal, what is this number? I'll give you another 30 seconds in case you thought it was positive. Now that we know it's a negative number, see if you can agree on what the answer is. Chat with your neighbors again for a moment, then we'll come back. Yes? Correct. The low order 32 bits. Mm-hmm. And what would that make the number? If it was unsigned or a long, if this was a positive number, what would the number be? It would be 2 to the 32 minus 1. I don't expect you to know the decimal expansion of that, but you're welcome to figure it out if you want. I do expect you to know ballpark how big that is. To the first digit, significant digit, what is 2 to the 32 minus 1? 4 billion. How do you know it's 4 billion? Huh. Okay, maybe you didn't see this trick. When I see 2 to some number, let's imagine it's a two-digit number. We'll start with two-digit numbers. So let's suppose I have just digit A and B. Those are not supposed to be hex digits. I should have picked something else. Okay? I know, let's do a little aside here. 2 to the 10 is approximately equal to 1,000. It is actually equal to 1024, but 1024 and 1,000, they're pretty close. Okay? And so if I have 2 to the 30-something, that is equal to 2 to the 30th times 2 to the something, because that's how powers work. And that, then, is roughly the same as 1,000 cubed, which is 1,000 million billion. So I'm in the billions range. And the remaining bit, in this case, was a 2. 2 to the second power is 4. So I'm in the neighborhood of 4 billion. Just a little over. This is a thing we won't have to do it a whole lot in this class. But if you end up doing C, C++, systems level programming, operating systems, this is the sort of thing you'll see a lot. And so knowing the powers of 2 between 1 and 10, and knowing how to decompose second level powers, will give you ballparks of the sizes of numbers. And we'll use these from time to time when we talk about how big RAM is and how many addresses we can represent in so many bits and so on. Questions? Okay, let me make this hopefully make a little more sense here. Okay. With n bits, the largest integer I can represent is? There's two correct answers. I heard several people muttering 2 to the n minus 1. That is one of the two correct answers. What is the other correct answer? Yeah. 2 to the n minus 1 minus 1. How can there be two correct answers to one question? What's the difference between these? Yes? Correct. This is the largest if it's unsigned. And this is the largest if it's signed. Now, there's no intrinsic reason why signed has to pick the same digits to be negative versus positive. But virtually every time you see a signed integer, it is a 2's complement signed integer. You should have learned at least briefly about 2's complement, and maybe that there were other kinds of signed integers in the 2150. 2's complement is the only one that gets used in almost all contexts. There is exceptions when we deal with numerical computation and floating point units, which we just won't talk about at all this class. So, huzzah. All right, I heard a lot of people talking about this next one. Does anybody think they have a solution to writing x left-shifted y without using shifts? Yeah. X times 2 to the y is correct. Why is that correct? How would we know that? Hey? This might make a little more sense if you think in decimal. If I did a decimal shift, so if I were to take a number like, 3330, and left shift it in decimal, I don't know how we're going to write left shift in decimal, let's do left shift base 10, 3, well, that would add 3 zeros at the end, right? Because that's what left shift does, is it adds that many zeros at the end, which is the same thing as multiplying by 1,000. This same logic works in base 2. It's the same thing. Left shifting is multiplying by a power of 2. Or, in the other direction, dividing by a power of 2. It's what it is doing. Questions? If I wanted to write that in C without shifts, how could I do it? Or C++, pick your language. I would write x times the power 2y. There is a power function in math.h. Many languages actually have a power operator, but C and C++ do not. All right. Last one, we got 4 minutes here, and then so I'll try not to take the whole time on that so I can say a little bit about what you should be thinking about going forward. So, if I know that x divided by y times x is the same thing as x, then what can I say about x and y? Yeah? Okay, so we have x might be 0. I agree. If x is 0, this will be true. Do we all agree? If x is 0, this will be true unless y is 0. So I can absolutely say y is not equal to 0. Because I couldn't divide if it was. All right, so y is not 0. And I'm going to say x is equal to 0, or the other part you said was? Y is a factor of x. How do I write that in C? I heard somebody say mod quietly, but I didn't hear the rest of what they said. I get 0 when I mod it. When I mod what by what? It's x and y. Which one's x? X first, x second. X first. All right. These are just a random sampling of things that I'm hoping you can remember. In theory, you learned how integers work in 2150. I realize 2150 taught you hundreds of things. It is likely you have forgotten some of them. If you're feeling at all shaky on any of this, I strongly encourage you to go read section 2.3 of the textbook, or go back and read the integer material from 2150 and brush up on it. We are going to assume you know this. In presentation, I'm just going to do binary arithmetic and change hexadecimal to things and understand that -1 has all one zits and so on. We're just going to use this. We're going to use some of these powers of 2 and log base 2, which is the other direction of them, along the way. You are certainly welcome to ask me questions and I will try to explain, but my assumption is this is information you know coming in. And so if you need to brush up, brush up. All right. 2 minutes left. Where should you be going from here? You have a lab to do on your own. You don't need to attend. There won't be anybody in lab today, although I guess you can go to the space if you want, which will be getting you set up to do the things that will come. There is a quiz which has no content. It's just about how the quiz works and so on, but you should take it so you actually know how the quiz works. It actually has some questions about how I write quizzes, the correct answers to which may teach you something. And we will come back next week and we will dive into assembly. So I'd encourage you to at least look at some of the assembly writing. I would hope you would read either the chapters or one of the write-ups before we come back on Monday. I will see you all on Monday.